Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Andy Griffith won't be on the ballot, but for three of our communities, there'll be a new sheriff in town.
Communities should always want to know from any elected official, in this case, a sheriff, what is your philosophy around public safety?
We'll hear from the experts what voters like you need to know when choosing your county's top law enforcement official. Plus, as turmoil rocks Eastern Europe, Superior plays host to an Estonian composer's stirring world premiere. Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
As turmoil rocks Eastern Europe, Superior plays host to an Estonian composer's stirring world premiere. Plus, Andy Griffith won't be on the ballot, but for three of our communities, there'll be a new sheriff in town.
Communities should always want to know from any elected official, in this case, a sheriff, what is your philosophy around public safety?
We'll hear from the experts what voters like you need to know when choosing your county's top law enforcement official. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We're all familiar with the sheriffs in TV and movies, from Andy Griffith in Mayberry to the Sheriff of Nottingham in any number of Robin Hood movies. But how much do we truly know about our real local sheriffs, even though it's the only law enforcement position we get to decide on at the ballot box? This fall, voters in our region will be picking three new sheriffs after those in Douglas and Ashland counties in Wisconsin and St. Louis County in Minnesota announced they won't be running again. What are the qualifications we should be looking for, and what makes a good sheriff anyway? Here to discuss those questions are Cedric Alexander, the former chief of police for DeKalb County, Georgia, in the greater Atlanta area, and later chief in Rochester, New York, and also a federal Homeland Security official. Welcome to Simply Superior, Cedric Alexander.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Robert Widener, professor of criminology at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Welcome, Professor Widener.
Thank you, Robin. I'm happy to be here.
So this isn't a political show. We're not going to offer speculation about who's going to be running for these open sheriff seats. But I wanted to give voters an idea of what we should be looking for in a sheriff. And before we get to that, what is a sheriff anyway? And why is it an elected position? Robert Widener?
Well, the sheriff has a unique role in the criminal justice system, for sure, in that they typically serve all three components of the criminal justice system: law enforcement, courts, and corrections. In most states, an elected office, including, of course, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, where sheriffs serve a four-year term. In a lot of counties, especially rural counties, the sheriff is the most powerful politician in the county. And there are roughly 3,100 county and county-like areas in the United States, and almost all of them have sheriffs, so there are a lot of them.
Cedric, you've been a chief, a director of public safety, I believe, a Homeland Security official, but not an elected sheriff, I don't think. What's the difference between what you've done and what these elected officials do?
Now, very early in my career, I did work as a deputy sheriff in Leon County, Tallahassee, Florida, and Orange County Sheriff's Office, and Orlando, Florida. And the sheriff position is an elected position. Historically, that's been the case. It is that number one constitutional officer that has a great deal of authority as it relates to county government. If they're a large enough agency, they're able to provide supports to your smaller municipalities, which is oftentimes city government or townships, et cetera, et cetera. Some sheriff's department, they just provide correctional services. Some are full service police type agencies, if you will, where they provide police services or calls for service and correctional service. Mm-hmm.
And what's the difference between a sheriff and a chief of police?
Well, primarily, a sheriff is an elected official. That's it. But primarily, the difference between the two is that the sheriff is county government, and city police are usually appointed by elected or appointed officials.
Mm-hmm. So both of you said that they wield a lot of power, but other than age or eligibility for office, what are the qualifications for office? District attorneys and judges are often elected, but they do require you to have a law degree. Sheriffs don't seem to have any particular training at all, except being popular with voters. Is that a concern?
You know, I don't know the statistics on this. I would assume that the vast majority of folks who run for sheriff do have a law enforcement background. I'm aware in the case of the election coming up with in St. Louis County that, to my knowledge, the two prime candidates are both have law enforcement backgrounds. So, yes, there's no hard and fast rule, but I think, you know, in practice, I think usually folks do come from law enforcement backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is true. Many of them do come from law enforcement backgrounds, but it's interesting just over the course of this past weekend, out at a Noble conference, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives in Baton Rouge, I met a woman there who has just been elected sheriff in Orleans County, which is New Orleans, and she has no previous law enforcement experience. So here again, it depends on where you are. And I think as we move forward and we begin to think and talk more around reform, you're going to hear more about those who will be applying, who may not have law enforcement experience, but may have some executive experience, some basic understanding of policing, if you will. And I think that's going to become something that maybe become more popularized by citizens in our communities who are looking for different perspectives. And it does not mean just because you don't have law enforcement experience, you cannot be a good executive, but you certainly, those that are in your chain of command must have an understanding and have experience would be incredibly helpful. But I've heard talk of this more and more behind the scenes of how do we entertain the idea of bringing people as head of police organizations, people running for sheriff who may not have had previous experience.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Cedric Alexander, the former chief of police for DeKalb County, Georgia, and Rochester, New York, and also a federal Homeland Security official, and Robert Whitener, professor of criminology at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. We're talking about your local sheriff with three sheriff positions in our area on the ballot this fall, where the incumbents are not running again. Those are Ross Lippman, the sheriff of St. Louis County in Minnesota, who first ran in 2002, Tom Daubeck of Douglas County, Wisconsin, who also first ran in 2002, and Mick Brennan, the sheriff of Ashland County, who was elected in 2010. Sheriffs Lippman and Daubeck haven't faced much opposition in their 20 years. So does electing sheriffs make them more accountable, or maybe in their case, less?
I think it's a practical matter, you know, can sheriffs be voted out of office? Yes, but as a practical matter, it doesn't happen that often. Statistic I came across was, you know, more than two decades is the average tenure for sheriffs. So while they can be voted out of office, and again, most sheriffs across the country, not all of them, but most of them serve four-year terms, in practice, they're kind of like, I don't know, Supreme Court justices or whatnot. They either retire or die.
Cedric Alexander, any commentary on that? How long they stay in and whether they're more or less accountable as elected officials?
You know, one freedom that sheriffs have, they are elected officials, and they will certainly play to the community in which they're running for office. You have some communities that are very conservative in scope, if you will, and you probably will find very conservative individuals running for sheriff in those communities. And then more moderate and left-leaning type of communities, you may find a different type of candidate who are more likely to run and win. The sheriff is generally a reflection oftentimes of the attitude of law enforcement in those communities. And that doesn't make it right or wrong. It makes it where people who live in those communities, they have their idea about their public safety. What is it that they want? Someone is just not appointed that they just have to deal with. They have an opportunity to go to the polls and vote for the person who's whose philosophy is more like theirs around public safety. But regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democrat or whatever party someone may run or ticket they may run up under, at the end of the day, they have to serve or should serve all parts of the community fairly and equitably under the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Also, as elected officials there, well, we just said several times, they're accountable to the voters. How does that play out when it comes to cooperation with other law enforcement agencies? And we've all seen the CSI shows where the FBI comes in and takes over and they argue about who's supposed to be in charge.
Well, if I could speak, you know, very candidly, you know, in my 40-some years in and out of policing, I will tell you, sheriff's departments are just as cooperative, just as involved with whoever is asking them for assistance. It doesn't matter who asks for help, whether it's from the feds, whether it's from the state, whether it's from the right or left or cities, towns, or villages, or wherever, because at the end of the day, it's not about the agency. It is about the mission.
Mm-hmm. Professor, have you seen that, observing it academically?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of following up, piggybacking on one thing Dr. Alexander mentioned about how, for example, sheriff's departments offer law enforcement services to smaller cities. That's definitely the case in St. Louis County. You know, St. Louis County is a very distinct county in a lot of ways. Duluth is his county seat. But it's the largest geographic county east of the Mississippi, 6,900 square miles. It's bigger geographically than Rhode Island and Connecticut combined. So what I'm getting at here, there are a lot of smaller communities, some of which contract with the St. Louis County Sheriffs for their law enforcement services.
All right. So both of you mentioned how this is one of the most powerful people in the county. And yet they tend to run unopposed. Rob just mentioned that the typical tenure is more than two decades, and we have two people leaving office who have exactly that and are often unopposed. So do you think voters are aware of their responsibility in choosing this person?
To the general public, a lot of people don't really particularly know the difference between a sheriff and a police officer. They just know that they're supposed to enforce the law. They know that one side of the street could be in the city limits, the other side of the street could be in the county. But regardless of where they are, they all operate under the same state laws. And communities should always want to know from any elected official in the public safety side, more specifically, in this case, a sheriff, is what is your philosophy around public safety? How do you view public safety in the 21st century? What are your thoughts about advancing technology into community policing? And what is community policing to you? And you adopt that philosophy. Is it meaningful to you? Or is it just a term that gets thrown around? These are the type of questions that need to be asked today. And in addition to that, you need to ask, who are the young people today that you're hiring? Are we training them at 21st century standards? Do they have adequate training that goes beyond just running and jumping and shooting, but do they know how to build relationships? Are we recruiting young people who really have an affinity to want to embrace diversity and equity among all people? Because quite frankly, issues around diversity and equity should not be the beginning of the conversation. People should already have that, whoever's running for office. If your conversation starts there, you're starting behind the eight ball. So I think it becomes important that citizens, regardless of who you're elected or who's being appointed, you ask those type of questions that are relevant in policing today. And how are we going to train better? And how are we going to make sure that your officers are well paid and have good benefits and feel inspired? And very importantly, and I'll end right here, very importantly, do they have good supervision? Because at the end of the day, it comes down to, and you'll see this across all disciplines, is that people want good leadership and they want to feel that they're part of an organization that cares about them and one that holds them responsible to the things that they should be doing.
Okay. Rob, same question, two parts there. One, do you think the public is aware of their responsibility in selecting this person who has so much power? And two, what should we be looking for in the candidate?
Well, I'll echo what Dr. Alexander said in the sense that I think most members of the general public, they're not thinking too in-depth about, for example, the difference between police and sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in terms of, like, what makes a good sheriff, I don't know that I agree with this, but, you know, sheriffs, because they're elective, they tend to almost always be from the places that they serve, right? So that's a pretty big distinction between municipal chiefs and county sheriffs. In terms
sure, because you're referring to, like, chiefs that if Minneapolis, for instance, in fact they do, right, needs a new chief, they might hire somebody from Kalamazoo, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, the former Duluth police chief went and became police chief at Wichita, Kansas, for example, you know, and on and on right. and on. But they, and by the way, too, I don't know if we mentioned this or not, but, you know, municipal chiefs tend to have much shorter tenures than sheriffs do.
Not 20 years, right?
Yeah, like 10 years would be quite a while for the typical municipal chief. So also just to kind of piggyback, and you know, I wholeheartedly agree with everything that Dr. Alexander said about training and accountability and being responsive to the community. I would just throw out there that, you know, because, you know, there are so many counties, so many of them rural, that have sheriffs, a lot of these places have smaller tax bases and probably lower salaries, less money for training, you know, and so the sheriff can have a really tough role in the sense of lacking resources with a limited tax base in relative to some municipal places with much deeper coffers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started out talking about fictional sheriffs, so I want to go back to that. And Andy Griffith, would Mayberry be our perfect sheriff candidate?
For today? Well, I think someone with his, certainly with his disposition, who seemed to have affinity for the job and for the people in his community, certainly in that aspect of it. But I, you know, in a very serious way, you know, we all know that since that 60s show, this country and everything in and around it certainly has advanced itself where we no longer, you know, allow Otis to give him the keys to the jail to let him and himself in and out of jail, right?
But I do like the idea that he didn't let Barney have a loaded gun.
That's right. But to the spirit of Andy and his concern and affinity to his community, God bless him. Yes, you know, so that type of character is great. In terms of a Barney fight, that is certainly dated. We need men and women who are certainly critical thinkers and able to go out here and operate in a world oftentimes that can be unfortunately very dangerous.
Right. Rob, last word on that. Do you think we'll have Andy on the ballot in St. Louis, Douglas, or Ashland counties?
Oh, boy. Well, I think media representations of the criminal justice system, that's a topic for another show.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap up this part of this show and stick to reality rather than fantasy. We've been speaking with Cedric Alexander, the former chief of police for DeKalb County, Georgia, and Rochester, New York, and also a former federal homeland security official, and Robert Widener, professor of criminology at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a world premiere from Eastern Europe at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Eastern Europe has been at the top of the news ever since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the world is on edge over the possibility of the war spreading to neighboring countries. But can we take a moment to mark a more peaceful, and I would offer hopeful note from that part of the world? That's exactly what occurred at the University of Wisconsin-Superior Music Department earlier this month with the world premiere of Stella Teagarden, a piece for choir and percussion by Estonian composer Irmas Siskas. Here to talk about it and to guide us through that performance, which we'll hear in its entirety in just a few moments, are Brett Jones, professor of music at UWS. Welcome to Simply Superior, Brett.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
And we're also joined by Eliana Lamy, who sang the second alto part as a member of the UWS Choral Ensemble. Welcome to Simply Superior, Eliana.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Brett, how did this all come about? And since I would assume you were a big part of its organizing, did you have any idea that Eastern Europe would be so much in the news when you started working on it?
Well, absolutely not. In May of 2019, our band took a trip to Estonia. And in preparations for that, when we were choosing musical numbers, there was an Estonian composer that I really admired and had played some of his works and listened to a lot of his works, Urmas Sisesk. And I thought that would be the perfect excuse to reach out to him and see if he'd be interested in ever being open to having a piece commissioned. So I made contact with him at that point, and though I didn't get to meet him while we were there in Estonia, it really opened up the door for this commission and him writing this kind of unique work for choir and percussion ensemble.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I have to go back even further in the background on this. Why Estonia? What if you threw a dart at the map, is that how you got there, or was there a particular connection?
Sure. So Estonia is actually home to a really fascinating musical, especially choral tradition. And there was during what was called the Singing Revolution in the 1990s in Estonia and Latvia, groups of people would sing folk songs, nationalistic folk songs, which were actually banned at the time. And that whole movement helped lead to the freedom of Estonia and Latvia and the fall of the Soviet Union.
Right. We should do a little refresher of history that the three Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, were part of the Soviet Union from, the end of World War II, I guess, until, as you said, the fall of the Soviet Union. Very similar to Ukraine and, like Ukraine, sharing common borders with Russia. So tell us about the composer.
Sure. He's a really fascinating composer. He's a kind of a minimalist composer, which means he takes a small amount of musical materials and kind of works with them and manipulates them. In a lot of the ways, though, he's a more approachable sort of minimalist composer than others, and writes very tonal music, so kind of music that we're used to listening to. He likes to blend religious music, oftentimes in Latin with Latin texts, with this kind of fascination that he has with astronomy. So many of his pieces point us outward to the stars and galaxies. And I think this piece in particular, he does a spectacular job of that, utilizing this Estonian poetry, religious poetry, but kind of translating that into Latin and then tying that to one specific star. Now, in 2019, when we commissioned this work, there was a discovery made by astronomers of two Earth-like planets that were discovered around the star Tea Garden. So Stella is Latin for star, Stella Tea Garden. Then we believe that he was kind of focused on that news item in 2019 and then basically wrote this piece around that one particular star. And when he does that, he does the astronomical calculations and basically reduces those down into musical intervals and then creates scales and melodies based on those sort of reduced ratios.
Eliana, I do want to ask, this piece is modern and minimalistic and unusual. There aren't too many pieces for choral ensemble and percussion. How difficult was it to sing?
It was pretty difficult. There's a lot of chromaticism and different pitches going on that we normally wouldn't sing in our typical music that we do here at UWS. I'm actually the sectional leader for the altos, and so learning that with them was definitely a new challenge.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about the performance of the world premiere, I should say, of Stella Tea Garden, a work by Urmas Sisesk, given by the UWS Choral Ensemble and Percussion Department members. We're speaking with Brett Jones, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and alto Eliana Lamy. So, Brett Jones, we're going to hear the entire piece. Can you, I always say this to our popular music performers that we normally have on the show, who have 3 or 4 minute songs, set it up for us. So this might take a little bit of setting up, but set it up for us. Tell us what we're going to hear.
Sure. So first of all, I think just looking at the text to kind of set the stage, the piece Stella Tea Garden is based on a poem by Uku Masin, who's an Estonian religious philosopher and poet. And the English translation of the text is, "We see, now we see, this small speckle on this cold night. And we are not cold because we see. Oh my God, would that I might now be able within myself to tell all things that this glimmer has known. Alleluia, the tea garden star, thanks be to God."
All right. Thank you, Brett Jones, and thank you, Eliana Lamy.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
And here in its entirety is the world premiere of Irma Siska's Stella Tea Garden, performed by the University of Wisconsin-Superior's Choir and Percussion Ensemble, Michael Fuchs, Choir Director, and Brett Jones, Percussion Director, at the Thorpe Langley Auditorium on March 10th, 2022.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, we just had a pretty comprehensive discussion about what qualities voters should be looking for when choosing candidates to fill the three soon-to-be-vacant sheriff seats in our region. Ashland County residents might also want to be aware of some bank accounts reportedly set up by outgoing Sheriff Mick Brennan's department.
Yeah, and this week the Ashland County Board voted to close these separate accounts maintained by the Ashland County Sheriff's Office after they were revealed in an audit. They approved a proposal to close two accounts that totaled more than $100,000 at the end of last year. And those accounts include inmate revenues from canteen sales at the Ashland County Jail, and that money will be transferred to the county's general fund and set aside in a restricted account for an inmate wellness program. And the county board also approved allowing the treasurer to call financial institutions in the region to seek out and close any other separate accounts that may exist. County board members had previously raised concerns about the lack of public oversight of those funds. And Ashland County Sheriff Mick Brennan has previously told WPR that there's been no mismanagement of those funds. He says those accounts have existed for roughly 20 years and has said that no funds have been stolen or have gone missing. But that's not entirely true, because roughly $41,000 has gone missing from the Ashland County Jail, according to the Ashland Daily Press. The jail's former administrator was investigated after he failed to deposit somewhere between $40,000 to $50,000 in jail revenues, but he died during that inquiry. And an investigation by the Douglas County Sheriff's Department found no evidence to support any charges of theft, but found that there was clear evidence of financial mismanagement.
All right. Well, nowhere near as secretive are plans by a Canadian mining company to do some exploration in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, a Canadian mining company known as Greenlight Metals, based in Toronto, appears to be moving ahead with plans to drill for gold and copper in north central Wisconsin after it received an exploration license from the state last month. They have also filed technical reports with Canadian authorities that say the Reef and Bend deposits in Taylor and Marathon counties have economic interests that warrant further exploration. And the company says that the Bend deposit, which is located within the Shawamiga-Nicolet National Forest in Taylor County, contains roughly 4 million tons of mostly copper and gold, while the Reef deposit, which is about a dozen miles east of Wausau in Marathon County, contains around 454,000 tons of gold reserves. And Ben Callen with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says the company still needs more approvals before it can begin drilling. He says the company plans to collect more information during the growing season about wetlands and surrounding habitat. That might require permits in order to move forward. And that information that's collected would also be included as part of the company submitting what's called a notice of intent. And that filing is necessary to outline the company's plans before they can begin any drilling.
All right. Well, I don't know if they'll be doing any of that mining exploration in caves, but if they do, they might keep their eyes open for the long-eared bat, if they can find one.
Yeah, well, and the northern long-eared bats are known for hiding in cracks and tight spots within caves. And so that makes them kind of difficult to find compared to other bats that, you know, you can see out in the open in caves. But now they're at risk of disappearing altogether. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced a proposal to list a bat as an endangered species because a deadly fungal disease has devastated the once common species. And so this disease, known as white nose syndrome, was first discovered in New York in 2007, and it was spotted in far southwestern Wisconsin just 7 years later. And over the last 15 years or so, the bat's population has declined 97 to 100% across most of its range. And Owen Boyle with the Wisconsin DNR says they used to see hundreds of these bats each winter during surveys, but now less than a dozen bats are typically found each year statewide, and he says it's arguably the most significant decline of a species in the state since the passenger pigeon extinction in the early 1900s. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is holding a hearing on its proposal April 7th, and it plans to issue a final decision by November.
Well, let's hope his population recovers. Rick, on the Minnesota side, there's a tragic connection to the war in Ukraine.
Yes, there is. Eveleth native Jimmy Hill was killed in Ukraine last week by a Russian bomb, according to U.S. State Department information that they relayed to his sister, Katya. Katya Hill discussed what she knew about the incident during a Zoom conference on Saturday. Jimmy, who was 68, was searching for buses to help people out of the city of Chernihiv in a safe corridor. And after seeing over 1,000 people in line for these buses, he then decided to turn back and check on his wife, Irina, who was in the hospital with multiple sclerosis. But before he could reach her, a Russian bomb was dropped into the civilian area near the hospital, killing Jimmy. Katya said the U.S. State Department does not know where his body is now. Jimmy went to Ukraine with his wife to pursue long-term treatment for her MS. Since the conflict began, he had been posting updates on Facebook about how he and his wife were doing. He reported how bombings were getting closer and closer and more intense. During his time in Ukraine, Katya said Jimmy was creating escape plans for himself, his wife, and Ukrainians. He has Airbnb properties in Idaho and Montana and was figuring out how many families he could place in those Airbnbs. Katya said to many people in that city, Jimmy was a local hero.
And our thoughts go out to his family. Eveleth, of course, is famous for his local hockey heroes. It has the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. We've got some local teams who've made good.
Yes, we have. The UMD women's hockey team had advanced to the NCAA championship on Sunday. Unfortunately, came a goal short of winning another championship. They have five championships altogether. Ohio State defeated them 3-2 on the campus of Penn State University. The Buckeyes joined the Bulldogs, the Minnesota Gophers, Wisconsin Badgers, and Clarkson Golden Knights as just the fifth school in 21 tournaments to win an NCAA women's hockey title. UMD went nine seasons between 2011 and 2020 with just one NCAA tournament appearance, but now has made the Frozen Four in consecutive seasons. Of interest for next year, the NCAA Frozen Four will be held at Amsoil Arena right in Duluth, and UMD is poised to maybe make another run at that. They return 17 of the 22 players that dressed for Sunday's championship to the team next season. Now, on the same day that the UMD women were playing in the national championship, the UMD men found out where they were heading for the NCAA playoffs, and they were scheduled to play Michigan Tech Thursday afternoon in Loveland, Colorado, and another on Saturday if they advance to then make it to the Frozen Four again in the men's tournament.
Well, congrats to both teams for their entire seasons. And I'm not going to say I'm saving the best for last, but how about the story with the most drama over the past few weeks? What is going on with the mayor of Two Harbors?
Well, the very latest in Two Harbors is that some residents of that city are collecting signatures as they try to recall Mayor Chris Swanson. After several weeks of meetings, a group of residents on Monday presented their certificate for recall of Swanson to city administration and then began collecting the almost 450 signatures, 20% of the registered voters in the city, that are needed for a recall to move forward. This comes after a really tumultuous 2 months for Swanson, which began with concerns over his underwater hotel and cryptocurrency pursuits and has led to other potential conflicts of interest and ethical concerns coming to light. The certificate lists examples of what the group says are violations of the city's code of conduct and ethics, and they include Swanson represented himself as mayor when soliciting funds for the Friends of the Bandshell Park through his business, which is called Garage Starts. They say Swanson failed to disclose that the newly formed First Day Events, which originally had the contract to organize the festival of sale, was formed by his daughter, Ashley, and run by an employee of Garage Starts. They also say that Swanson used his Twitter account, which identifies him as mayor, to promote his nonprofit National Civility Association. And another note that they have is that Swanson, in a podcast about the underwater hotel, stated that being mayor, he gets a little bit of sway, that he's able to secure quite a bit of funding through the state. Now, according to the Two Harbors City Charter, a recall petition can move forward if 20% of the registered voters sign a statement of removal that outlines, quote, allegations of malfeasance or nonfeasance. There were 2,241 registered voters in Two Harbors the morning of the 2020 general election, and that means that almost 450 voters in the city would have to sign this petition for it to be considered by city administration. As it is right now, Swanson's term is up in January 2025.
All right. I got the feeling we haven't heard the end of it yet, regardless of how the petition effort fares. We've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with, well, you know what it is, even if you haven't quite heard it this way. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.